Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto, Public Media, and WBFO, this is What's Next Producers Picks, highlights of a conversation heard on a previous episode. On today's show...
When it comes to women in construction, I feel like a lot of they have a lot of influence from males in their life. I talk to younger girls who tell me that their boyfriend doesn't like that they want to go into a career with a bunch of guys. Mm. Or their father doesn't feel like they're strong enough to work in construction.
Marie Patton, the vice president of the National Association of Women in Construction's Buffalo Niagara chapter. And we close with...
But once you get in your car and you go out to the situation, the crisis, to intervene, I think those skills haven't really changed in the current times. I think the basic thing about staying focused, knowing why you're there, having a team member you can rely on to make a determination.
Bob James from Western New York Vets and Carolyn Damon from Spectrum Cares. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. First, we revisit Jay Moran's conversation with Marie Patton. The two discuss how the construction population still has a very small portion of women and how the organization she's a part of are looking to fix that.
Well, there is so much to talk about here. As a matter of fact, let's maybe just start things off. I think if I read my statistics right, 2020, about 1 in 10 construction jobs in the United States belong to women, for lack of a better term. But right off the bat, I'll just ask you, it could be a lot more than that, couldn't it?
It could be. Yes, absolutely. It could be. There are so many openings in construction, from everywhere from being in the field to being construction adjacent, construction support, safety. There's really a lot of potential for somebody to have a really great career in construction.
And so from what we do hear about the job, not so job shortages, but the shortages of candidates for a lot of these jobs, that's real.
Absolutely real. Yes, absolutely real.
Companies are looking for people.
Every day.
What's the disconnect, though? It sounds like, there's opportunities there. And we can maybe talk about compensation as we move through this as well. But there's opportunities in this field, and yet they're not being filled. What do you see as the disconnect then?
I feel like a lot of potential employees don't realize that the jobs are out there. Also, when it comes to women in construction, I feel like a lot of they have a lot of influence from males in their life. I talk to younger girls who tell me that their boyfriend doesn't like that they want to go into a career with a bunch of guys. Mm. Or their father doesn't feel like they're strong enough to work in construction. The hours are early. So, for some reason, there's this perception out there somewhere that women don't like to get up early, which is really silly. But there's a lot of barriers, I feel, for women, especially.
Right.
As far as what society expects from them.
Let's talk about some of those barriers and take the perception and break down the perception into reality. First, let's just start with you and your journey into this. You're here talking for both your company and also for the National Association as well, but you found your way into the world of construction. How did that come about?
I did. I want to impress upon everybody that, your life, it's okay if your life takes different turns.
Right.
It's going to happen. And I think a lot of people don't realize that it's just something that you have to work through and you have to reach out to your resources, right? So I graduated from high school and I went to Buff State to become a high school history teacher. That's what I wanted to do. My life took a different turn.
Okay.
Life happened. I ended up becoming pregnant with twins. Mm. So
congratulations on that one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
it was a lot of work. And so I, obviously couldn't continue my studies at Buff State. I went into the veterinary field. I became a vet tech for a long time. And that actually was a lot of really long hours, Saturdays, Sundays. So you don't really get a break there. So it was difficult. It was becoming increasingly difficult for me to try to get childcare, things like that. And I, you know, found a company after I had my my last son. I decided I was going to be a stay-at-home mom, and I had been working for a company that placed construction labor, the one that I'm working for in a different, you know, in a different iteration of it.
Right.
And I decided I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. So after 2 years of watching Sesame Street and all those fun programs that we see on PBS,
right.
I said, I can't do this anymore. Reached out to the company that I'd been working with, and they placed me with an industrial demolition company.
Okay.
I started out part-time as a receptionist. Somehow I got drawn into their safety program.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the safety coordinator. So I set up things like fit tests because we had a lot of welders. We did deconstruction, not detonation. So we had a lot of welders that were employed for us. So I started to get into, you know, different safety trainings and fit tests. And I was able to travel a little bit with them, go on job sites. And then essentially management changed and I was not able to go out on job sites anymore because they didn't feel like it was safe for me to be on job sites with a bunch of men.
May I ask you this? What was it like the first time you walked onto a job site? Again, like you said, the deconstruction of or breaking down of these structures.
So I was lucky enough to have a very good mentor.
Okay.
He was a good old boy from Texas. And he was 70-ish years old when I was, and this is 15 years ago. And he basically, you know, took me under his wing and said, just stick next to me. Stick next to me. You'll be fine. But it's very intimidating to walk onto a job site, especially a busy job site, because there's all kinds of things going on. With demolition, you know, you have people that are detaching all of the utilities. You have people that are moving cranes around. You have people that are erecting cranes. And that's, you know, not to mention all the people that are on the ground, okay,
right.
And all the people that are on the radio. So it is a little bit intimidating, and it was a little bit scary. But taking that first step was also really thrilling.
Oh, really?
Because I felt like I think I finally found where I want to be.
That quickly?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were convinced that you wanted to leave the office behind and be out on these sites?
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how did that expand for you then? So then you started traveling, you started going around to different sites around the country.
I did. I heavily in Texas and Louisiana, and also West Virginia. And then I, like I said, management changed, and I felt myself hitting that glass ceiling.
Okay, all right.
Where I could see where I wanted to be, but I just was not able to make it there for different reasons. Management reasons.
Sure.
So I ended up at a safety supply company. I was in their training department, and I got to do a lot of training with different construction companies, got to make a lot of really great connections, and I eventually became their corporate compliance representative. And then in August of 2019, the company that I'm with now, one of the owners called me and said, hey, you know, we have to bump up our operations in Las Vegas. I have to move out there. Can you come and run our Buffalo office?
Mm.
Without hesitation, I said, absolutely yes.
Okay, all right.
Because I could foresee, I knew that they were a great company. I knew
This is Active Workforce, where you are now, right now. Okay.
Yeah, I knew Active Workforce is a great company. They had a lot of long-term clients. And I felt like I had enough safety knowledge and training to be able to take Active Workforce to that next step and offer, because we are a woman-owned business, do only construction placement from labor to highly skilled carpenters, drywallers, you know, plumbers, HVAC. We get into all of it. So there was a real need for our employees to make sure that they had the access to safety training, and that has spread now to our clients. I do site safety audits for some of our clients. I work with some community-based organizations that offer building trades training programs, and I offer their OSHA 10 classes in construction so that they're outfitted to come out of that training course with everything that they need, including the safety aspect of it.
So you go to, like you said, these community-based organizations. The idea is, when you do that, this is as much not only just to train people on safety in these situations, but it's also a bit of a recruitment effort as well?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a really good resource. And I feel like a lot of the companies that I work with, may not know that this resource is out there.
Right.
I placed somebody 2 years ago with a large construction company, and he was hired right out of one of the building trades training program with 716 Ministries. They come out with basic tools. They come out with an OSHA 10, basic knowledge of the mechanics of construction, and he is now a site foreman for them.
How much do you know about that journey from starting off to the 2 years to a foreman? I mean, how did they start, I guess, is what I'm curious about. And I mean, I obviously weren't there every day to see they're progressive, but I'm just curious how that's quite the ascension.
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, basically, all he did was show up with ambition. He advocated for himself. Because he felt like he was getting stuck doing something for too long, he would reach out to me. And I mean, this was far after he was my employee.
Okay.
He reached out to me and said, I think that I need to go somewhere else. I said, well, what's going on? And it turns out he felt like he was stuck doing one task the entire time that he'd been there.
Okay.
And I said, well, I can certainly talk to somebody for you, but I feel like it's important that you need to talk to somebody as well. So we figured out who he should talk to, and he did talk to them. I made a follow-up phone call with that person, and now, you know, they moved him up. And a lot of times, the management on site gets so busy doing everything that they have to do,
right,
because they have to wear so many hats. They don't always have a full-time safety coordinator. They're being the foreman. They're in charge of time and materials. They are in charge of safety. They're in charge of, you know, keeping track of everybody's hours. They wear a lot of hats, and they often don't realize that things are getting a little stale for their employees.
Right.
You know, and they don't always recognize that there's an employee that shows up every day on time that wants to do more, that wants to learn more, that wants to perfect their skills in carpentry, drywall, concrete, what have you.
It's interesting that you mentioned the advocating for yourself, because we had a conversation before we went on the air, and I want to see if we can't get this into a larger part of it. But, you know, we talked about, you know, 1 in 10 of construction jobs are filled with women. I believe the numbers are even less when it comes to Black Americans. I mm-hmm. think maybe 1 in 20 mm-hmm. is the case. And we talked also a little bit about trying to break down some of these walls. But it's interesting what you say about that. You say advocating for yourself on the site inside these companies is the key to getting not only, you know, ahead, but also job satisfaction, it sounds like, as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And when I do classes, I teach OSHA 10 in construction, OSHA 30 in construction to a very diverse group of students. And I always like to chit chat a little bit, get to know them right during breaks and lunch and things like that. And I always try to impress upon the class, listen, when you get out onto that construction site, and I'll show them pictures like that I have taken at construction sites. I'll okay. show them pictures, show them what's going on, show them videos of things that happen at construction sites just to make it a little more real to them. But I always stress that it's so important to advocate for yourself. If you feel like you are not doing enough, you're not learning enough, you need to take that to somebody on the site that can be an advocate for you. But it's important to advocate firstly for yourself. You have to know your worth. Use your voice.
And I'm going to also make the imagine that there are mentors waiting to happen. We talked also, and I think I mentioned this, but my dad was a construction mm-hmm. worker. He didn't find a great student in me, but when I was interested in those rare occasions, he was always more than willing to and excited to help me learn which end of the hammer was the one to use.
Mm-hmm.
But is that the case? Do you find that with a lot of the people that are on these sites? That, you know, I mean, you know, obviously they got to concentrate on the work and being safe mm-hmm. and getting it done, but they're more than willing to help out.
Yes. Yes, they're more than willing. Sometimes they need a little push
mm-hmm.
Because they're not always sure if that's something that's allowed. But through NAWIC, we've been reaching out to the McKinley High School students, BOCES High School students, and trying to let them know, you know, we consider us a resource. We are now in your network. We can guide you to wherever you feel like you need to go. So in that in that aspect, we are offering that mentorship through NAWIC.
Right. And you're NAWIC, or the National Association of Women in Construction. You've just got done with a week of events,
we
right?
We did, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's talk about a few of those events and what they were all about and how successful they were.
Oh, it was such an exciting week. We always do. So we've been, for the past 3 years now, we've been celebrating WIC Week, and it's been growing. The first year, I think we only did a coffee hour and a job site tour. Last year, we did a coffee hour. We did the Girls in the Trades Day and a job site tour. And then this year, we had 3 full days of events. So we had our kickoff is always the coffee hour. We had at Birchfield Penny, which is a beautiful facility.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really a nice change for us, because we had been having it at 500 Seneca.
Okay.
So, and 500 Seneca is a lovely building. They have a beautiful atrium, but we kind of outgrew it, honestly,
really?
Because
okay.
our coffee hour is very successful. We had over 130 people at the coffee hour this year.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was including McKinley students.
Right.
And I think there were 15 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that every WIC Week to kick it off. This is our second year of doing the Girls in the Trades Day with the female students from BOCES. And there were 26 of them. And that was the same average as last year. So they followed. And they weren't all the same students, but there were some that were, you know, seniors this year, and they came back because it was a really exciting program last year. So we bring them in to Danforth. We do a tour of the fab shop for them. We have panel discussions with NAWIC members, you know, of different, as I said, our members range everywhere from tradeswomen to business owners. This year we focused on construction adjacent. So we had a construction lawyer. We had someone that worked in construction sales. We had a woman that ran her own business doing placement for project managers, estimators, architects. So a little higher level than what I do at Active Workforce.
Okay.
And the girls were great, great group, super excited. We finished off with a job site tour for them. At the end of the day, they went over to UB South to see a job site in action. And honestly, you know, they were so much more engaged after that job site tour, and even after the panel discussions, than they were in the morning.
Really?
I mean, I was a teenage girl. I know what it's like to, I mean, you know, okay, I got to go on this field trip and figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up. But they you could see them blossom and really engage with people. I had girls coming up to me asking me for my business card because they want to talk about going into safety, which I'm always thrilled about because
sure.
I hardly ever get anybody who wants to go into safety. So, yeah, that was great. And then Thursday we did our big, this was the first time that we'd done it. We partnered with the Office of Federal Contractor Compliance Control and Workforce Buffalo and had an intro to construction careers at Buffalo Educational Training Center, or BETSE, as it's commonly known.
Okay. A one-day event?
It was a one-day event.
Right.
Yep. We started at 10 in the morning. We had a fall demonstration trailer outside. So the students that came in the morning got to see that. And we had, oh gosh, I think 4 or 5 different schools that showed up.
All right.
And a ton of vendors, over 30 people that tabled that wanted to spread the word about, you know, welcoming more women into construction. So we had the unions there. We had the community-based training organizations were there. We had architectural firms there. We had construction companies there, government agencies, OSHA, OFCCP, they had tables. And it was a lot of really great information.
And you saw engagement. You saw these young people
mm-hmm. yes.
getting interested.
Yeah, I actually moderated a panel of women in construction, and it was a full room, and they had great questions for the panelists.
What were some of the questions?
Basically, just, you know, kind of how you got started out. One of the girls had a great question, you know, have you ever had any issues on a job site where somebody wanted you off the site because you were a woman?
Hmm.
You know,
was the answer yes?
You know what? Surprisingly, it was not.
Really?
It was not. And I feel like, I mean, I've been in construction for a long time. I've seen a lot of things, good, bad, and different. And I feel like there has been a lot of growth. Do we need to do a little bit more? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. There are still, you know, there's still some disparity out there. There's still a lot of miscommunication There's still a lot of people that think it's okay to say certain things that they really should not because it's rude and basically it's against the law.
Right. Workforce issues, no doubt about that. Wow, that's really interesting. Well, here, let's get into the possibilities of compensation. I think this is important as well, right? You know, I mean, it's interesting. You're talking about your days, you know, working as a veterinary assistant, right? And I'm thinking, you're working all these long hours. Could I maybe also intuit that maybe you weren't making all that much money either?
I was not making all that much money. I was not. And at the time, I was a single mom.
Right.
So, you know, my penny stretched. And, you know, one of the stories that I like telling as an advocate for myself, I went to the county for childcare assistance. That's all I wanted because I got this great job at a veterinary hospital and all I needed was childcare assistance so I could pay somebody to watch my twins while I worked. And I was going to be making $5 too much.
Wow.
So I said, okay, well, I'll just go down the hall and I'll apply for everything. Everything the county can give me, everything the state can give me, I'm just going to sit at home and take care of my kids.
Okay.
Backdoor conversation was had, and somehow I got the child care assistance.
Wow.
Very important to advocate for yourself because, you know, just because something is written on paper or somebody's telling you something doesn't always mean that it's the truth.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you've got quite a story, Marie. I mean, do you find, though, that in general, women also still have to advocate a little bit more for themselves on these sites and in these companies?
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. On the flip side of the coin, though, Jay, I have clients that call me and say, do you have any females available?
I bet.
Because they tend to be more responsible. They tend to be more detail-oriented.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know the person in my household who has all of those skills and a lot more. There's no doubt about that. Marie Patton is with us today on What's Next. She is the vice president of the National Association of Women in Construction here in Buffalo and also the director of operations and safety at Active Workforce. And there's so much to get into here. But, you know, I think I already know the answer from you on this, but maybe you can just take it a little further. When you see the level of complexity involved in these sites, like what you're talking about here, I mean, I would have to think for somebody who has a healthy curiosity, there it's got to be a very intriguing. There's a part when you get into that field where, again, you know, we start off with the concept of you're going to be the person sweeping up. That's going to be your starting job. But there are all sorts of possibilities when it comes to these sites and what people can utilize their skills to do.
Right. And again, that kind of dials back to advocacy because I have known people that went to a construction site and maybe they were, you know, sweeping up for a couple of weeks and another contractor would come up to them and say, hey, you know, I'm with such and such company. How do you feel about helping me hang this piece of drywall?
Right.
So that's kind of how, you know, people get sparked to do other things. I have students that will shadow me on my safety audits. And I had a student recently who was an electrical at a BOCES program, BOCES Erie 2 in Iroquois. And he was amazed when I took him into a building that I had was doing a site safety audit on because he said, I've never seen a building. I mean, they were down to the studs.
Okay.
It's a bigger project. They were down to the studs. And he said, I've never really thought about what the building looks like when you have to take everything out,
right?
You know, and he was just amazed by the whole site visit. And, you know, and one of the things that I try to encourage people to do too is cross train. So if you are in an electrical class and you want to go into electrical, great. Learn how to do drywall too. Because then you don't have to pay a drywaller to come in and patch the hole that you just had to had to knock out of the wall to install an outlet.
Right. That's a great thought on that regard. Because, and again, there is all this knowledge out there at these sites. There's so many different people who have different skills. And again, when it comes to, you know, when you're talking about construction, we always have to keep in mind that we've mentioned this before, there are big companies doing big jobs.
Yes.
There are small companies doing small jobs as well. Again, maybe just take us through that understanding of what's available and where people can go with these careers.
Oh, I wouldn't even know where to start, Jay. There's so much going on. I mean, we have all of this great architecture, all of these great old buildings.
Yes.
And I've been in Buffalo my entire life. I've traveled to a lot of places, but Buffalo will always be my home.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I plan on living for the rest of my life. And I've seen the cycle. You know, I've seen the cycle of, you know, the West Side where I currently live. You know, that was a place where nobody wanted to be, and now everybody wants to be there,
right?
Because they're finally embracing all of these grand old houses. 500 Seneca is a perfect example. I remember going in there, and before they started redoing that building, and the atrium that is so beautiful right now was literally like the world's worst swimming pool. I have no idea what was in there. It was gross. It was disgusting. It was just 30 feet of water and garbage.
Oh.
So to see that whole process take place, to see the transformation of that building, really fantastic. And that fascinated me. And that is not going to stop anytime soon. You know, the transformation of all these beautiful old buildings. So there is a lot of work out there.
Right.
Just because you don't get called up for the stadium, just because you don't get called up for the 33 project, doesn't mean that your construction career is over or it can't start.
Right.
There's plenty of work out there.
And I think we also had a conversation that I, when it comes to these bigger projects, the downside when you're a smaller company is, you know, you might be too small, not because you can't do the work, but you just might not have the financial capacity, because there is a financial consideration for these smaller contractors on these shops.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when active workforce goes on site, we have to carry a certain amount of insurance, and a lot of the smaller companies just can't carry that amount of insurance, especially for these bigger jobs. But it might be good for like a 500 Seneca project, or, right, you know, an East Side building project, or the 42 North Brewery that's opening at the old Tent City. You
right.
know, there are developers working on every corner of Buffalo and beyond. You know, there's things going on in the suburbs, too.
And I'm also very curious about these courses that people take, that like building and trade courses, right, that are available in a lot of different places, which, again, it totally surprises me where these are showing up.
This is why I love my job,
yeah,
because I get to talk about these places that I found that are wonderful resources for the community. There are at least three that I work with. There's a building trades training course, and not only building trades, but other training courses. You know,
okay,
so if somebody wants to go into customer service, somebody wants to go into nursing, Catholic Charities has programs. 716 Ministries has a building trades training program, and they have actually worked on a lot of their own buildings. So what they do is they train these folks. They train a class to, you know, on the mechanics of construction, building trades, and then they put them to work on their own projects on the East Side first, you
right.
know. And then, you know, if they want to move on, if they want to find something else, they have employer partners that they can reach out to say, hey, you know, this person has showed up every day, knows what they're doing, has their OSHA 10, try them out for a little bit.
If you can, take me through then what those courses, like you said, you kind of generalize it, but let's get a little specific about what exactly, you know, you're learning at it. I mean, you know, I know you've got a lot of other things going on. You're not necessarily sitting there watching what goes on, but, you know, what are you learning when you go to these courses? I mean, we had that conversation about the 77-year-old woman that mm-hmm. was taking the course, which is mind-blowing. But it's interesting that there's an opportunity to utilize this in so many different applications. So what are they learning?
Absolutely. So the instructors are very well versed on the many aspects of building trades. So mm-hmm. the students learn a little bit of plumbing, a little bit of electrical, carpentry, drywall. You know, basically anything that you would need to know to either go into a career or to fix things on your own at your house. So 716 and Catholic Charities, very basic. Assembly House, the SACRA program at Assembly House, a little more fine-tuned just because it's a construction arts-related program.
Okay.
So they focus a lot on rehabbing older buildings, rehabbing older furniture, the more artistic aspect
right.
of
okay.
it. I actually had one of their instructors redo a table leg for one of my friends on a 150-year-old table that she had been holding up with books.
Wow.
For years, this table was held up with books. And I finally said to her, I'm like, look, I know this guy that can probably help you out with this for a donation to wow. Assembly House.
And that's how that worked.
And that's how that worked, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, the students that I've met, the stories, that I cry at almost, and I try to attend as many graduations for these programs as I can.
Oh.
And some of the stories that these students give, some of the heartfelt gratitude that they express during graduations is just, it's so inspiring. And I've cried at several graduations because I know these students, you know, and I spent at least two full days with them when I do their OSHA 10 and construction courses. I haven't known them for over the whole 12 weeks. So to hear their stories put in such a heartfelt way is really just inspirational.
Would you mind sharing some of those stories? I mean, we also talked about how stories are a big part of the way you go about training.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be interested to hear about some of these stories. I mean, it sounds like you're seeing, you know, life transforming moments.
Absolutely.
With these people.
Absolutely. I mentioned before that a lot of these students come from a very diverse background, very different backgrounds. So you may have single mothers in the class. You may have single fathers in the class. You may have people that have, you know, recently gotten out of being incarcerated. So there's, you know, oh my gosh, so many stories. I couldn't really single out one. But, you know, there was at Assembly House, one of the first graduations that I attended there, there was a woman who had been addicted to drugs.
Okay.
And so she went through a drug treatment program, and her counselor suggested that she go through this building trades training program. And just hearing her story and about how she was at the lowest point in her life, and that day of graduation was like her 6 months out of drug treatment program. The day of graduation was 6 months, her 6 month anniversary, and she just was so grateful to be alive, to be able to learn this and to be able to take this and make a new life for herself, this training that she's got, and make a new life for herself.
Wow.
And funny story, I actually ran into her recently.
Really?
How's
she doing?
She's doing great. She's doing great. She had a baby.
Okay.
She's doing great. She's still working. She's doing side jobs. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And construction-related jobs?
Yeah, and construction-related. And that's the great thing about going to these building trades training programs. I mean, not that I'm advocating for, you know, people to go out and do this necessarily, but like maybe a little bit. I mean, for instance, if your mom needs a new window,
right,
you have the skills to do that
right
now. You know, if your uncle wants to pay you to put in a set of stairs, you have the skills to do that now.
Yeah, self-sufficiency.
Yeah.
Wow, that's
yeah.
That's
so I'm not advocating for, you know, off the books work, but
of course
to help out friends and family. You know, now you have the skills to do this.
Right, helping yourself as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, and helping yourself. There's a woman that I still keep in touch with that graduated 2-ish years ago from the 716 Building Trades Training Program. She came to me after graduation. I set her up with a larger construction company, and her story was fascinating to me. She told me that when we were on a break, she said, well, the reason I got into this program is because I'm living with my mom and my sister who is disabled, and our landlord wouldn't come over and fix the stairs.
Mm.
So I went on YouTube, watched a video, went and got the stuff I needed, and fixed the stairs. And I thought, wow, I'm pretty good at this, she right. says to me. I'm pretty good at this. Maybe I should take some training courses for this.
Right.
And she ended up at the 716 Building Trades Training Program.
Are there, then that brings us to an important question, are there finally certain talents, I'm going to stretch, I'm struggling with my words here, which is not unusual, that finally in the end, you, if you have this type of, these types of talents, this type of aptitude, that's the word I was looking for, this is the place for you? Or do you sense that maybe it's more adaptable than that, then there really are opportunities for everybody?
I feel like a lot of people discount going into the building trades because they feel like it's not achievable.
Right.
Because, you know, they have never handled a tool, a power tool before. That can all be learned. Hmm. Honestly, that can all be learned. You know,
and we know somebody who can help with the safety aspect.
Exactly.
Of that as well.
Yes. If you ever feel unsafe, just call me. I feel like that's kind of an open ended and an interesting question.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever got asked that question before.
But it's worth exploring.
Absolutely worth exploring. I mean, the 77-year-old woman who learned everything else in her life,
right,
and now she just wants to learn how to fix things around her house, you know, to have the skills to be able to fix things for herself around the house. You know, you don't have to use these building trades training programs as a career, but it's a great option.
Right.
You know, I had a student into active workforce recently who failed out of college. Found out a few things about his life that he was unhappy with, basically was at his lowest point. He felt like he was at his lowest point. And my policy at Active Workforce is we're not just going to put people on a job site because we need people on a job site. So we will take, you know, people that look like they're struggling. I mean, I'm a mom. My senior recruiter's a mom. We have that mom energy going on. So we can tell when people are struggling a little bit. So we will steer them towards one of these building trades training programs. Come back to me when you have some confidence, basically, is what we're telling them.
I see. Okay.
Because sometimes that's all it takes, is just a little bit of confidence. Like, okay, the first time you rip a piece of wood with a saw, you're not going to be great at it. But the more you do it, the more comfortable you're going to be. And if you're doing it under, you know, a controlled condition with somebody watching you and guiding you, then that is going to build up your confidence to do it 17 more times.
That was Marie Patton, the Vice President of the National Association of Women in Construction's Buffalo Niagara chapter. And we close with Jay Moran sitting down with Bob James from Western New York Vets and Carolyn Damon from Spectrum Cares. The three speak about mental health first responders and the importance of having them as a resource.
Today, we're going to talk about mental health first responders. With us, Bob James. We've talked to Bob before from Western New York Vets. Bob himself, a former crisis services outreach worker. Bob, thanks for joining us again.
Yes, sir. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having us.
And Carolyn Damon, supervisor for Spectrum Cares. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
So, Carolyn, you're in the supervisor business, and we talk about mental health first responders. Talk about just the people that want to do this work, that come to find this way in the work. Maybe even share a little of your experience, how you came across doing this.
Sure. I started in crisis work back in 2008 as an outreach worker at Crisis Services. I had no experience in crisis work prior to then. I worked in residential centers, I worked in schools, but I had never done crisis work per se.
Right.
So that was very eye-opening. And it was such a great experience that I keep coming back to crisis work.
Right.
So even though I left outreach, I found my way back to Spectrum Cares. And now I do the same type of work with the 17 and under population.
17 and under, huh?
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be a significant difference, I would think, to a certain extent. Or maybe not. Maybe I'm jumping to conclusions that what 17 and unders are dealing with are a little bit different than adults.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The issues certainly are different. The way you have to go about it is also different.
Okay.
Because when you have an adult client, you can talk to that client one-on-one. You don't have to get permission from anyone. You don't have to ask for consent from anyone.
Right.
You can just go out and do what you need to do to complete your assessment.
Right.
When it's children, you have to get permission from legal guardians, you have to get families involved. There's usually a treatment team of some sort, either school-based counseling or outpatient counseling. So there's a few more layers with the children just because of the age and that lends to that. But as far as issues that I see with the kids these days, so much of it involves social media,
really?
School, bullying, cell phone usage.
We keep going back to the phone, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much, and it causes so much anxiety and depression and exacerbates their suicidal ideations if they have them. And it's a lot that they're struggling with.
At the same time, though, so then you know the problems are different. Well, what about, and you know, you have to go through these layers, especially when it comes to young mm-hmm. people. Well, once you're through all that, your approach, is it different with a younger person than an older person?
I would say so.
Okay.
With adults, I think you can be a little bit more blunt and direct most of the time when you're out to address the concerns. Sometimes with kids, especially depending on the age, you have to finesse things a little bit, especially with the younger ones. If you're going to assess a kid who's like 4, 5, 6 years old, they may not even understand what suicide is.
Right.
And you have to find words and ways to explain it to them so that they understand. When you get into the older teenagers, it's a little bit different. You know, they have a better understanding. And usually when you go to see them, they know why you're there.
Right.
So it's easier to be a little bit more direct with them.
Bob, I've heard you agreeing with a couple of things that Carolyn said there. That's was your experience as well?
Well, yes, it was. And I think how it worked when I was at Outreach, and it was a long time ago that I was there, and we were talking a little bit about Carolyn and I were talking earlier about how the technology has changed.
Yeah.
You don't have a beeper on your bedside table like we did back in the 80s that would go off in the middle of the night, but you have a cell phone. So when you're on call, it still comes in through a different technological tool. But once you get in your car and you go out to the situation, the crisis, to intervene, I think those skills haven't really changed
right.
in the current times. I think
right.
the basic thing about staying focused, knowing why you're there, having a team member you can rely on to make a determination. One example might be an elderly person that has fallen and they live alone and they have a neighbor that knows that they've fallen and they've hurt themselves and they have maybe a broken hip and they're declining that they have anything wrong with them. You know, ambulance might be called and can't determine what's going on. They think there might be something that's psychological or mental about it. So they call the crisis team to go out and make an intervention to assess a couple things. Is there risk involved? And is there some evidence of mental illness? If somebody might be delusional or hallucinating or there's some evidence of mental illness paired with risky behaviors, then the team has the authority to be able to kind of really nudge someone and sometimes call the police and have somebody transported for an evaluation. So that's one example. Memories I have of some of the outreach visits, we're going into a house and very often elderly people living alone. I remember a couple of visits where the person had been hoarding stuff. And the only way to get from the front of the house to the back of the house was a little pathway right. along the floor where everything was heaped up to the walls to get from one end to the other. So didn't make an intervention. That's some evidence of some risks, some health risks. And we get a blitz team that comes in once the person's
blitz team?
Gotten.
What's a blitz team?
A blitz team is what it was called back then. Somebody will come in from the health department and assist cleaning up somebody's house so it's more habitable.
All right. Okay.
You know, so they'll take all the stuff out there and make it cleaned it up and get the person back in the home to sustain them living in the community. But it might be some evidence of mental illness that people, you know, this is a whole different science in terms of why people hoard stuff and save newspapers that go back 20 and 30 years and go to almost junkyards and get stuff to fill up their houses. And those are things where the team would make an intervention, make an evaluation to determine what would be the best outcome, the way to support the person, kind of maintaining the level of health. So that's just a couple of different examples of the kind of things that we would see. And I would say for me, my capacity to have genuine, deep compassion came from doing that kind of work, seeing people that have kind of fallen through the cracks of the system and they're out on the, kind of the fringe in terms of what might be considered healthy on a lot of different levels. You really see people that you wouldn't see otherwise without doing this kind of work. So you develop a sense of compassion. And when Carolyn was talking earlier, I thought, parents that have a child that has a very, very high fever, let's say 104 degrees,
right.
people know that as parents. But when you have another parent with you, it's much easier to stay calm and make a decision on what to do. But imagine if you're alone with a child like that, it's more of a sense of urgency and life and death in a crisis. So the beauty of working with teams is that you have somebody you can step outside if you have a moment to do that and make a decision on what's the best response we can use or we could bring to this situation.
Appreciate Bob's story.
I've said a lot here.
No. And I appreciate what you said there, Bob. And I'm going to turn kind of to Carolyn the same way. And we talked about this before we went on the air, that this would be a great opportunity to share some stories, and we want to make sure that we do our best to keep anonymity, of course. But how about for you, Carolyn? Is there a story from when you think of your career of dealing with, you know, crisis outreach, being a mental health first responder? Is there a story that, that kind of solidified your experience and made you know that, A, you know, you're doing some important work here, and B, that there was a reward for you and that there's a certain sense of personal, I don't know if satisfaction is the right word, but that the connection that that happens when you know that you're doing the right work?
Yeah. I honestly, I don't know if I could pick one mm-hmm. single story.
Right.
There are so many.
Yeah.
I think to piggyback on what Bob was saying, we did see that a lot in crisis services, especially with the elderly population,
right.
because a lot of times they have medical issues that mimic psychiatric issues.
Okay.
So a lot of times we would get called out and we would have to make a clinical determination as to whether or not does that fall under mental health or is that a medical issue that they need to be seen by a physician, not a psychiatrist.
Right.
Those are always interesting. The hoarding, obviously, to have a peek at somebody's life and how they live and to see how their OCD has manifested into the hoarding situation. There was actually a client I went to see last week in CARES, and it was kind of a full circle moment for me because when I had worked in a previous role at a different agency, I had worked with this girl. She was about 5-6 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And I knew when I was leaving there, she was in the midst of getting removed from her family. Fast forward to last week, and I happened to go out to see someone, didn't recognize the name. She's in foster care, having some suicidal ideations. Mm. They weren't sure how to best assist her. Turns out it was the same little girl that I knew from when
wow.
she was 5-6 years
wow.
old.
Oh my gosh.
I knew her mom. I knew her siblings. I was able to use that history that I had with her to safety plan and keep her at home and not have to go to the hospital.
Did she remember you when you saw her?
When I kind of jogged her memory and I was like, you remember I was at your house like every other week and I worked with your brother? And then she was like, oh my gosh. So yeah, that.
Oh, good.
And so that helped with the situation.
I think, it helped the whole situation and the whole crisis that we were dealing with at that moment. Just having that connection and knowing like, that's somebody that I recognize in my life.
So there's no substitute. Well, there is a substitute for experience, but experience pays off in these situations.
For sure. Yeah, you never know when you're going to come back in contact with someone that you've helped before.
What about keeping people with experience? Is that a struggle? What about this particular aspect of dealing with people being a mental health first responder?
I would say the nice thing right now about Spectrum Cares is that myself and the other two supervisors that are there, our director and our program manager, all three of us worked at Crisis Services Outreach together.
Okay.
So we all have that experience.
Right, right.
And we all really enjoy this field, so that's why we're all still here.
Sure.
I think the team that we have now definitely has a decent amount of experience. They're younger, but they're building. I think it's a type of work that you have to find out if it's for you. And I think some people do it and they find out it's
sure.
definitely not for me. So right. I think that's where the turnover rate comes in sometimes with the crisis work. But I think once you find those people who really have that passion and the love for it that we do, you tend to stick with it because that's kind of your thing.
Right. With us, Bob James and also Carolyn Damon. And we're talking about mental health first responders, those people who are out there who go into situations where they've got to make decisions about people and their current situations and make recommendations. I'll throw this out to both of you. What is the disposition that makes an ideal person to do this type of work? Or are there many factors involved there?
I don't know. It's almost like a chicken and egg situation. Do you develop a sense of resilience from the work, or do you have a sense of resilience that leads you to do the work? I don't know.
Right.
But I know that having done the work for a while, you develop a sense of resilience because you have to stay focused and stay in the moment and work closely with another person that sometimes you may not agree in terms of what the best outcome might be. But you have to work out a solution between two people in terms of what the best response might be.
Any expansion on that thought, Carolyn?
I think I tend to agree. I'm not sure which comes first either. I do think you have to have a real passion for the unknown and uncertainty and every day being different. And I think some people who really prefer a routine and like going into the office and knowing what to expect every day and what is going to happen, maybe that's not for them.
Right.
But if you like a change and you like a fast pace and you like not knowing where your day is going to lead, this is the job for you.
Sure. Well, then let's.
That's a really good point.
You intrigue me about that. So let's talk about the day. Let's just say, you know, you go. You go to an office to start the day, then what's going to happen? You might be sitting for hours?
I mean, there are days, yeah, especially we tend to be busier during the school year because we get a lot of calls from school counselors, school social workers, principals, that kind of thing. During the summer, sometimes there's not as much going on and sometimes it's a little bit quieter, but somebody's always having a crisis somewhere.
Right.
And we are always needed somewhere.
Right.
So yeah, there's days I will walk in the office at 9 a.m. and I could be out the door to a school in Akron. And then when we finish there, we might get a call and say, okay, now you have to go out to Gowanda on the other side of Erie County.
Right.
And you have to go out there and do an assessment. You really never know where you're going to go.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or where the day will take you.
Is that kind of your experience too?
Yeah.
Bob?
I mean, yeah. There were days where we would go in and never sit down.
Yeah.
Come in and up on the board. And again, this is back in the 80s. Up on the board.
We still use the board.
With chalk or with markers, erasable markers. There'd be a list of ACT open cases. And I think it is the same way that people can call 834-3131, talk to a crisis phone counselor 24/7. And then if it looks like a situation that needs to get referred to for a potential outreach visit, it gets referred to that team. Then they make the assessment. And they make a determination, does something need an immediate visit? Does it need follow-up or whatever? And this is, again, this is back in the 80s in terms of how it operated. But then you'd never know when you walk into the work what was on the board for that day. Well, we needed to do a follow-up visit to this situation because it's not imminent, but it needs follow-up. We need to go back out and see if this situation has resolved itself. Sometimes we'd go, like Carolyn said, you go from one visit to the next, you'd go all over Erie County and out to the edges of Erie County as well sometimes. And you'd see situations in inner city that were very different than situations
rural.
That were way out where they were rural. And one wasn't more crisis than the other. It's based on what was happening in the community. Sometimes, and this is an essential thing to learn and to understand, is sometimes you need the police involvement.
I was just going to ask about that.
And there's an authority that master's level people get from Mark O'Brien, who's a friend of ours, who's the commissioner of mental health, former outreach worker, called the 945 authority. It gives you the permission. It's part of New York State mental hygiene law. It gives you permission to authorize involuntary. She's got her card right there. I lost mine when I left crisis services, which is fine. But you call the police and they would preside over a transport for somebody to go to ECMC. And I'm not sure in the rural areas if they would go to someplace else.
For Erie County, the only place we go is ECMC these days.
It's a designated recipient.
Carolyn, you're doing a nice job of, you know, obviously you love your work and what you do. But there's a huge responsibility. You're going to make a decision here and a recommendation on people that could potentially be life-changing.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I don't think it's anything that you can ever take lightly.
Right.
When you go out, you have to be focused. You have to be objective. You have to look at exactly what's going on. Is this person an imminent danger to themselves or somebody else? Are they safe to be able to remain in the community? Or do they need to be taken over to the hospital and seen by a psychiatrist to make a further determination on that? It's a huge responsibility. And I think it's something that we all definitely take very seriously. And we all do our best to make sure that we make the best clinical assessment in that moment.
And is that interesting story you told us about the youngster who was a 6-year-old foster child, and then you met up with the individual later on. In that case, you did get to see maybe an outcome of sorts.
Right, right.
Do you always?
No, not always. No. The nature of crisis work is very short term. Mm-hmm. So we are called in usually only when there is a situation or a crisis. So our main goal is to go in, mitigate that crisis, make sure everyone is safe, And then we usually close out involvement. Most of the time, though, that individual is linked with long-term services.
Okay.
So they have ongoing services. We are just there to help with the crisis aspect.
Short term. At the same time, the information occasionally floats back to you, what happened to somebody?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are always those clients, whether it was in outreach or now in CARES, there's always clients that you end up getting kind of an update on and, oh, remember so-and-so and, you know, they're doing great now or, you
That's got to be very satisfying.
Yeah, it's rewarding to know that, oh, years down the line, somebody that I saw is actually doing well.
This has been quite the conversation. Mental health first responders. Is that your own term there, Bob? I think it is.
I think it
I'm
is.
Not sure. I mean, well, I thought about how can we title this in a way. So we talked about with Crisis Services and Spectrum, we talked a little bit about what the handle is. And the handle is, same thing, like I said, fire and police and military and emergency, you know, EMTs and all that, not EMTs, emergency, you know, ambulance drivers.
Yeah, EMTs. Yeah,
they're all, sure. Okay, yeah. Thank you. They're all considered first responders. And a friend of mine who's actually, I'm not going to name by name, was saved by a fire company first responder not that long ago. The first responders save lives, and it's not overly dramatic to say that. And in mental health these days, more and more, there's that need for those kinds of people to be available 24/7 to go out wherever, whenever, to help resolve a crisis and save lives.
Well, Bob James, Western New York Vets, of course, we've known you from that before, and also your time at Crisis Services and Outreach Worker. Thanks for being with us,
sir. Back in the day, yeah.
Absolutely. And Carolyn Damon, Supervisor at Spectrum Cares. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And also want to remind anybody who is listening to this program right now, if they are undergoing a certain type of stress themselves, the Suicide Prevention Line, National 988.
Right.
And, of course, if you know someone else who could use that as well. But the bottom message is there are many people out there willing to help you, and hopefully you can find that help.
That's hopeful.
Yes.
And that will do it for Producer's Picks. We thank our guests, Marie Patton, Bob James, and Carolyn Damon. If you missed anything or would like to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. Thanks for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.